All right, this is the Torah portion of Bamidbar. It's the fourth book. We're going to do the beginning and the name of the parasha. Later we're going to do it in a very interesting way, I have to tell you. The Baal Shem Tov said something that when I was a kid, it was so sad. But then you get older and you see that it's really a big deal. Baal Shem Tov says, everything a person sees or hears can teach him something how to serve God. Because of social media, a certain thing started out on Twitter today, and now, if you were young enough, you would know that it's buzzing all over the whole world, and it's something that fits exactly into Parsha, into the name of the Parsha, into Shavuot coming up, as you are going to find out. Before that, we're going to do something else, which will be a nice, important message, and I was debating whether to do it at a sermon or here. I'm doing it here. Maybe I'll do it again at some point. Here it is. We're on page 860 in the Kutnik Chumash, which is the fourth Torah portion, and let's pay attention to something. It's chapter 3, verse 1. Ve'ele toldot Aharon Moshe. These are the descendants of Aharon and Moshe. And then it goes on to say, Be'yom dibar Hashem et Moshe b'har Sinai, on the day that God spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai. In other words, what it says, that we're going to list now the children of Aharon and Moshe. So now, let's just scan very quickly. Verse 2. Ve'ele shmot b'nei Aharon. These are the names of the children of Aharon. Verse 3. Ele shmot b'nei Aharon. These are the names of the sons of Aharon, etc. And then it goes on to say something else about them in verse 4. Verse 5, God says to Moshe as follows. And he talks about the tribe of Levi in verse 6, what they should do. Now please turn the page. And we'll go to verse 11. God says to Moshe the following, whatever it follows. Verse 14, Hashem says to Moshe at the desert of Sinai to count the tribe of Levi, etc. And then if you turn to page 864, it says, verse 17, Vayihiyu Ele b'nei Levi, and these were the sons of Levi by their names, Gershom, Gehosa, Merari. Okay. And you're going to need to trust me, but if you keep turning the pages, it talks about children of the tribe of Levi. And all the way till the end of the parsha. You keep going. And guess whose children are not listed here? Moshe's children are not listed here at all. Okay, let's go back to where we started. 860. It says, Ve'ele, and these are Toldot, the descendants, Aharon of Aharon, we saw a lot of that, Moshe, and Moshe, and there's no children of Moshe listed at all. So why does it say that it's going to, that the following are the descendants of Moshe? Okay. So here we have something that Rashi tells us. And Rashi says as follows, if you can read in the Hebrew, you'll take a look in Rashi on page 860, the very first line. Ve'ele toldot Aharon u'Moshe. I'm reading from the Hebrew now because I don't see it here in the English. Ve'eino mazkir ela b'nei Aharon. It only mentions the children of Aharon. V'nikru, yet they, the children of Aharon, are called toldot Moshe, the children of Moshe. Why is that? So Rashi explains, quoting from our sages, of course. Lefi Shelamdan Torah, because Moshe taught Aaron's children Torah. So what? Melamed, this teaches. Shekol ha-melamed et ben chavero Torah. Whoever teaches the children of his friend Torah, ma'ala alav hakatuv ki'ilu yaldo. Torah considers it as if you gave birth to him. So this is a very, very important point, because not everybody has children. And not everybody teaches their children Torah necessarily. And here we see something about if a person teaches someone else, it says the children of someone else, because that's the context, that it's if you give, as if you've given birth to them. But everyone is somebody's child, right? Otherwise we wouldn't be here. So in other words, if you teach somebody else Torah, it's as if you've given birth to them. So this, part one, I brought this to you because I'd like to share with you a very significant story of the Baal Shem Tov. And this is its introduction. And the introduction is explicitly buried within the words, not buried, alluded to in the words of the Torah itself. It's not an interpretation of an interpretation from a perspective. No, it's very clear that Moshe's children are simply not listed here. And it calls somebody else's children, his brother's children, Moshe's children. So with that in mind, I'd like to share with you the following story. Now, this story, I wish there could be a huge crowd listening to this story, because this story relates to many things that are very personal, including, and I'm going to say it, what a person writes in their will, and many other things that are going to become evident as I share this story to you. Now, I'm going to apologize in advance, because this book here, which is the life of the Baal Shem Tov, and these only contains authoritative stories, because there's many stories that are said where the sources are, maybe it's embellished. But anyway, because my eyes are reading in the Hebrew and I'm speaking in English, so I'm going to try to sound as normal as possible, but whatever fails me in that department, you'll please forgive me, because the message is truly powerful. The Baal Shem Tov, this is how it begins. The Baal Shem Tov absolutely loved simple people who feared God with their heart and whatever they did just for God, even though they didn't know much. Among such people, there was a certain fellow, his name was Moshe Shlomo, and he lived for some 28 years in doing business in villages and so on, and he was connected to the Baal Shem Tov, even though he didn't do much. He made that a nice living. And he would distribute a lot of tzedakah. Now, the Baal Shem Tov gave this Moshe Shlomo, we should remember his name, Moshe Shlomo, blessings, as a result of which he became very, very wealthy. After 25 years of being married, Moshe Shlomo had no children. And every time he would ask the Baal Shem Tov to give him a blessing for children, the Baal Shem Tov would bless him instead with wealth, and he would be silent about the blessing for children. Well, so they didn't have children yet, and then one of the days, the Baal Shem Tov called over Moshe Shlomo and his wife when they had come to a visit. I'm sorry, there we go. Let me just back up for a second here, because I'm trying not to read every single line. Once, when they came to Baal Shem Tov, him and his wife, for blessing for children, and they just begged and begged, and they were really, really sad. The Baal Shem Tov says, "Why are you so sad? Didn't God bless you with tremendous wealth, with good hearts, and you do lots of tzedakah?" So, his wife's name is Rivka, I see it here now. So, Moshe Shlomo and Rivka, they both answered, "But we have no children." And the Baal Shem Tov said, "So what?" So they said, "What is all this wealth worth if we don't have children and we have nothing that we're going to leave behind?" So the Baal Shem Tov said, "Tomorrow, you," meaning both of them, "are going to travel with me, with some of my students, to a particular city." Okay. Now, the Baal Shem Tov used to take many journeys with lots of stories. And as I said, this is absolutely reliable as follows. Next day, they travel for 5 days. They didn't know where they were going, but eventually they came to a particular city near the city of Brod. So they came down and they got themselves settled. And then the Baal Shem Tov said, "Let's go take a look at this city." When they say city, it's not like Vancouver. Whatever city looked like, or shtetl, exactly, a shtetl as it looked like in close to 300 years ago that this was. So anyway, they go along, and there's a group of kids playing, Jewish kids playing, and the Baal Shem Tov says to one of them, "What's your name?" He says, "Baruch Moshe." There's another kid, "What's your name?" "Baruch Moshe." Another kid, "What's your name?" "Baruch Moshe." A fourth kid, "What's your name?" He answers, "Baruch Moshe." And so on and so forth. Another kid, "Baruch Eliyahu." In other words, lots of kids being called Baruch Moshe and some having either part of the name Baruch or Moshe in their names. Then there's another group of kids playing. They're girls. And one of the girls says, my name is Brachaleia. Okay. And then they go around and there's more girls. And they ask, what are their names? Brachaleia, Brachaleia, the same thing. So many kids in this shtetl named Baruch Moshe and Brachaleia. So now, and also some kids, okay, Bracha Miriam, etc. But you get the idea. So now the Baal Shem Tov is going to get to the bottom of this. How come they all have this these names? So they asked, just a second. They go around further, they meet more kids, boys and girls, and the same story repeats itself. And then they meet a certain fellow, and he's a teacher in one of the chedorim there, one of the schools there. He says, how many cheders are there here? He says, about 25. And he tells them where they are. So they go to other cheder, different chedorim where the kids learn. And they go over the same thing. Baruch Moshe. And what was the other name? The girl's name was Brochalea. So many kids. Okay. So then they go to shul and the Dav Mincha. And after that, the Baal Shem Tov goes over to one of the fellows in shul. And remember, everybody's following them, including this couple who he wouldn't bless them with children, just with wealth. And the Baal Shem Tov asks his fellow in shul, how come there's so many children that they all have this name, either Baruch Moshe or Brachaleia? So this fellow in the shul tells this story. He says, more than 100 years ago, in this city, there lived a certain fellow. His name was Isaac Shloima. He was God-fearing. He was learned. He was a butcher. Okay, wealthy, etc., etc. And many years passed by. They didn't have children. And then, 15 years after being married, they had a son, and they called him Baruch Moshe. So he grew up, but he didn't succeed in his learning. They didn't know about whatever names we have today and so on. He didn't succeed. So when they realized that he's already bar mitzvah and the learning just doesn't go into his head, so they got him involved in, you know, their butchery, and he did a really good job. Fine. Now, 10 years later, they found a shidduch, and he got married to a girl, Brachaleia. So sometime later, about a year after the getting married, after this fellow Baruch Moshe and Brachaleia got married, his father, the one who we started this sub-story in, he died. So there we go. So there's Baruch Moshe and his wife, and what are they going to do? He decided that he wanted to learn Mishnayos after his father. So I just want to explain this for a second. The Talmud is comprised of Mishnah, which is paragraphs of law. They were compiled 1,800 years ago. 300 years later, the explanations of those paragraphs were then published in the form of the Talmud as we know it. The word Mishnah literally means teaching. The word Mishnah has the same letters as Neshama, which means soul. There is a custom, and I'm going to explain in part the reason, that if one wishes to study Torah in memory of someone who passed away, to study specifically Mishnayos, Mishnah. And they say because the letters of Mishnah are the same letters as Neshama, which means soul. But that's just like a little play on words. It doesn't really give the reason. The reason is that Mishnah is a combination of God's wisdom and mitzvot. Why? Because Mishnah doesn't go into any analysis. It just says, this is how you do the mitzvah. You do it like this and like this. That's it. So in other words, you have God's desire, which is the mitzvot, and God's wisdom, which is the Torah, coming together in Mishnah. So it has a special uniqueness, and therefore for the elevation of the soul, the maximum elevation comes through a combination of Torah and mitzvot in the study of Mishnayos. Back to the story. So this is Baruch Moshe. He wants to learn Mishnayos after... his father and mother died. That's right. So he wanted to learn Mishnayos after, in their memory. And he paid a teacher to learn with him. He didn't, and he just didn't go inside his head. Now, I want to interject something, and I'm only going to tell just a part of the story because I've already told it so many times over the years, that I was once in a particular city in a store of paper goods, frum guy, and he's obviously running a business, and you cannot stay in business if you're a total idiot. And for some reason, he says to me, and I don't know why, he was older than me, he says, and he's born religious. He says, I don't understand Chumash with Rashi, without interpretation. It just doesn't go into his head. I've paid people to teach me. It doesn't go into my head. He went by the Rebbe for dollars. The Rebbe didn't answer. Didn't. And he said to the Rebbe, I want to be able to understand Chumash Rashi. The Rebbe didn't answer him. However, whatever I said to him, but I'm just saying, there's such a thing. So anyway, what could he do? So he can't learn the Mishnah, so he's good businessman, but the learning doesn't go into his head. Anyway, one day, Rav Baruch Moshe is sitting, this butcher Baruch Moshe, he's sitting in one of the chairs near where they're learning, and there's a fella in the shul, and he's teaching. And he hears the teacher saying this piece of our sages that we saw in the Rashi. Whoever teaches the child of their friend Torah, it's as if they give birth to them. So that really penetrated him, because he went home after davening and it says for some reason he went home together walking with the fellow who was giving the shiur, and he gives a big sigh. So the fellow who gave the class says, why are you sighing? He said, because, we have no children, and I heard you say that if you teach your friend's child Torah, it's as if you gave birth to them. We don't even have children. I'm not able to learn anything. What am I going to do? So this teacher says, you are misunderstanding what our sages say. And to this I want to say that I translated the Rashi word for word, and the surface sounding is not the full picture. That's really what this story is coming to. So this fellow, Reb Shlomi Yitzchok, says to Baruch Moshe, he says, it means something different than what you think. It means that when you are the cause of other people learning Torah, it's like you gave birth to them. So, for example, that if you sponsor the salary of teachers, for example, tuition, etc., and because of it, those children are learning, it's as if you gave birth to them. And what happened in the ensuing years is this: Reb Baruch Moshe, he became fabulously wealthy. And as his wealth grew, he kept sponsoring more and more all of the chedorim that were in this shtetl. And eventually, when they passed away, so in gratitude for that, those children throughout that shtetl, they called him Baruch Moshe after him, and the girls Baruch Alea after her. And they also used to do on the yard site a whole to-do in that shtetl. So now, the Baal Shem Tov, remember now, the Baal Shem Tov has taken this group, including this fellow who can't learn, and he says, to this Moshe Shloime and his wife, the ones who originally we started off the story with, and he explains to him as follows. He says, look, this is how you can have children of your own. You are wealthy. You can sponsor Torah study. It's as if you gave birth to them. And now you understand why I didn't just start off with a story. I wanted you to see that it's an imperative that's embedded within the actual wording of the Torah. That it says, these are the children of Aaron and Moshe. And Moshe's descendants are not listed here. Only Aaron, because he taught them Torah. Okay? This is part one. So really, it, just to say it in Hebrew, there's an expression to say it, Barachel Bitcha Ktana, to say exactly what this means is that a person can have merits of this kind when they help other people learn Torah, right? So that is the end of part one. I mentioned at the outset today, the Baal Shem Tov says everything we see and hear can teach us about how we should serve God. And something that literally started Tuesday night, last night, meaning to say the 15th of May, when last night. Don't say a word. Okay, if you know what it is, don't say a word. Unless in answer to what I say to you. You know why I'm saying that, right? Okay. So here is what it is. Basically, today it exploded. The reading is not important because I'm going to do the audio and the visual. The, you know what you need. You'll see what it is. So we have said many, many times that the theme of the entire Chumash of Yiddishkeit really is the coexistence of a contradiction. And you'll see, this really goes right into it, with the name of the fourth book, which is Bamidbar, and its content, and so on. So here is something that has gone, what they call these days, viral. A very short 2-second clip in which there's a certain word. There's a word, Yanni, and a word, Laurel. Okay, Yanni and Laurel. When you play it, some people hear the word Laurel. Some people hear the word Yanni, right? Some of the Yanni, Laurel. And I have a number of things to say about it. So on this particular page, put out by the New York Times, what they have done is they have taken that audio file, and first we're going to hear how it normally is played. And if you don't mind, I'm going to go around the room, and even though you know about this, doesn't matter, just tell me which one you heard. And there's no right or wrong, as you're going to find out. And then I'll go further in progression, because obviously we're leading to something, as you're going to hear. So, I press this button, it says click to play.
Yanni. Yanni.
Oops.
Yanni. 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 Yanni.
Okay, so Nora, I just had to do it again because I had the speaker and the microphone in the wrong spot. But, so now let's go around the room. What did you hear?
Yanni.
Yanni.
That's amazing, because I heard Laurel. I only heard Laurel. I tell you, I heard Laurel. So now what's going to happen is there's a slider here, whether you could see it or not, and I am going to slide it over, and when one of you can go in the direction of Laurel, you can go in the direction of Yanni. Since you all said you heard Yanni, I'm going to slide it in the direction of Laurel, and if you could sort of speak up when you hear Laurel, because not everybody will hear it at the same movement in, you know, in the slider. Okay, so I may as well do it like this, make it a little easy. Okay, so here goes.
Yanni, 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 Yanni. Laurel.
Okay.
Laurel. 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 Mm-hmm. Laurel.
Okay, now you hear it, yeah?
Laurel.
Okay, now you did notice, not everybody, didn't change for everybody in the same time. And now, I'm going to go to the other direction. We actually will go to the center again. And I'll tell you, unless it could be that you'll hear it differently, I don't know, we shall see. As a matter of fact, let's do it.
Laurel.
Okay, what are you hearing now? You are hearing Laurel, and guess what? It's back in the same point in the middle of the slider, okay? So now I'm going to move it over towards the Yanni side, and you'll speak up when you begin to hear Yanni, okay?
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
No.
Laurel. 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 Yanni. Yanni.
You hear Yanni?
Yanni. Yanni.
This is the first time I hear Yanni, right?
Yanni.
The first time.
Yanni. Okay.
Right? So as I said, just towards the very end. So I tell you some interesting things. So this was sent around on a little forum between shluchim for the subject of speech is actually for Shavuos, and I decided this is, I'd been preparing class, and I see this, and I said, oh, this fits in exactly with what I'm preparing. So I'm going to do it now, and I can't play this on Yom Tov anyway. All right. So what I want to say is, actually, the next thing I'm going to do, I'm sorry, is I heard a number of videos, like the one I'm going to show you, which is a short one, and interestingly, in one of them, the guy says that he cuts off whatever, you'll see what he does on the screen, and he says, and now you hear such and such, and I heard the opposite one. This same clip, depending on which video, sometimes I heard it one way, sometimes I heard it the other way. Okay, so now let's go to somebody whose student says why he feels he has an opinion on the matter, to explain it, just because of his background and what he's been doing for a living. And we'll see what he says. And of course, this is not just for fun and all that, but we're going to see how it relates to what we're doing. Okay, here we go.
Hey guys, how's it going? Yes. Today, I want to show you
So is it Yanni or is it Laurel? I'm going to talk about that here today. So, hey everyone, my name is Doug. I run a company in Orem, Utah called Doug Johnson Productions.
Whoops, sorry.
We do video production, but as part of that, I do a lot with audio. And I've personally been working with audio for nearly 40 years, so I feel at least somewhat qualified to talk about this. So if you haven't heard already, there's this thing going around the internet right now, kind of it's trending on Twitter at number one at the moment. This girl, Chloe Feldman, shared this clip on her Twitter feed asking whether we hear the word Yanny or the word Laurel. Let me just play that real quick.
Laurel.
I hear Yanny now. Other times I
About 50% of the population is hearing Yanny, about 50% is hearing Laurel, and a handful can hear both. So I'm going to save it till the end to let you know which one I heard first. But let's talk about, from a audio point of view, what's actually going on here and why some people are hearing one versus the other. So what I've done here is I've taken the clip and I've brought it into Adobe Audition. And what you're seeing on screen here is a spectrum analysis of the audio. So over here is the beginning of the clip. This is the end of the clip. Down at the bottom is lower frequencies. At the top is higher frequencies. The intensity of the color, whether it's red or yellow, and basically indicates how loud that particular frequency is at that point in time. Now, one thing that's kind of odd about this, and something I noticed right away, is that this is not a normal distribution you would find with normal human speech. Normal human speech, you'd have a lot more energy in through here than what this does. So there's something strange going on here, and it's not what we're used to hearing. The other thing I noticed was that the patterns up top don't mirror the patterns at the bottom. With normal human speech, you'll see that when there's intensity down here, there's also intensity up top. Those are harmonics. That doesn't happen here. So it's pretty clear from what I'm seeing here that these are actually two distinct signals that have been overlaid on top of each other. So let me actually let you hear them both, and you can decide for yourself. So if I highlight this lower section right here and play that.
Laurel. Yep. Laurel.
You probably hear the word Laurel. I certainly do. Now, if I select the upper portion and play that, Yanny. Yeah. I hear the word Yanny there. So I think what they've done is they've taken two distinct audio signals, taken the lower portion from one, the higher portion from the other, and combined them into one. And that's why we're able to hear both, because both are actually present there. Now, as for why you hear one versus the other, there's any number of reasons. The quality of the speakers or headphones that you're listening on can play a big part of that, and whether they emphasize the higher frequencies or the lower frequencies. But also your brain's predisposition to hear one versus the other. You know, for example, if you know somebody named Laurel and you hear their name all the time, your brain becomes trained to recognize that pattern, and you're probably more likely to pick up on that. So a lot of things going on. So personally, I heard Yanny over and over and over again, and it wasn't until I turned up the audio and listened on good quality of studio monitors that I actually was able to make out the Laurel portion of it. I can hear it, but I have to strain a little bit in order to get my brain to ignore the upper frequencies so I can actually hear the word Laurel there. So anyway, sound off in the comments down below. Let me know which one you hear, and make for an interesting discussion. So thanks for watching, and have a fantastic day.
All right, so we're going to take that, and we're going to apply it to the parasha, to us, to today. So to use that for today's parasha, we're going to take a sidestep to a piece in our Siddur, page 157, Shabbat. And this is a poem that's 500 years old. It's said by pretty much every community on the planet, Lachadodi. So just to understand who is putting this together, we have three great people who basically in the same shul in Sfas, small Jewish community, that had one of the greatest impacts in the world. We had the codified Jewish law, Rabbi Yosef Karo. And we had in the same shul, we had the Arizal. We know a little bit about him. The version of this Siddur, if you look at the front cover, it says following the Arizal's edition. And there was a Python, a liturgist, meaning he was somebody who, amongst other things, wrote liturgy that was accepted by the Jewish people. Now, we know a little bit about arguing and how to argue as a people. He composed this poem called Chadodi, and the whole Jewish people from one end of the world to the other said yes. I point this out because in the second chapter of the poem, which says, Shamor, observe and remember, they are in quotes, Shamor v'zachor, observe and remember, b'dibur echad hishmianu ken amyuchad, the one and only God calls us to hear in a single utterance. What is he speaking about? Well, I'm not going to make you turn the pages because this part we've actually done previously, but in the story, in the narrative of the giving of the Ten Commandments, we're going to be reading it, of course, on Sunday, Shavuot. It says, remember the day of Shabbos and keep it holy. And then when it's repeated in the fifth book, second portion, Va'et Chanan, it says, Shamor, guard, which means you have to be careful about certain things you don't do. Guard the day of Shabbos, it's the fourth commandment. Shabbos is the fourth commandment, honoring parents is the fifth. So the fourth commandment, so how come those words are changed? Well, there's a verse in Tehillim, King David already answered the question. And I figured I wouldn't have to open it up, you'll just trust me, it's in Tehillim in Psalms chapter 62, where it says, Achat diber Elokim, God spoke one. Shtayim zushamati, I heard both. I heard two things. God said one thing, and I heard Shamor and Zachor. I heard Laurel and Yanni. Okay? Now, I'm not just getting to this because it sort of sounds cute. You'll see we're going to go a little bit deep as well and personal. So, in other words, God said two things at once, except that God saying two things, it's really one thing. So how could that be? Do you remember how I said really at the outset that the theme of the entire Torah is the coexistence of contradictions? So I want you to pay attention to how the very same thing was stated by Reb Shlomo Alkavetz, the Paitan, the liturgist of the Shul of the Arizal and Reb Yosef Karo, where he says as follows, Shamor, the word guard, which is in the Torah portion of Et Chanan in the fifth book, second parasha. V'zachor, which is in the Torah portion of Yitro, which is the second book. Shmoyz v'erboi b'shalach Yisrael, the fifth portion, section. It says, Zachor, b'dibur echod. In a single utterance, Hishmianu kelam yuchad. The one and only God made us here. Now you'll notice that we're talking about duality, two different words. Because remember is an active thing. Remember the day of Shabbos, you know what it means? Make Kiddush Friday night. That literally, that's the biblical commandment. To make Kiddush Friday night is the fulfillment of the commandment of remembering Shabbos. Much, much more important than making Kiddush Shabbos by day, which is rabbinic. It's rabbinic. And this is the commandment, the fourth commandment. But then it goes on to say, Hashem Echad, God is one. Ushmo Echad, and his name is one. Now, maybe you are connected to your name. We all are connected to our names. But you and your name, really, you could say two separate entities. But the truth is, your name is connected to you. And you can have more than one name. You can be called Levi Yitzchak, two names. You can be called a nickname. You can be called a whole bunch of names. So when the Paitan, when the liturgist is pointing out here, you have one God and his name. The idea of a name is it could be duality and really comes together. Two, that's really one. So I'd like to share this story, which I'm going to butcher the story because I thought I would find it in a particular book. and I thought it's in that particular story. I don't find it there. So I'm just going to say it this way, whether this is exactly true or not, but the concept is really the same. Because, first to introduce, I showed you it on the page of the New York Times. Why did I have to show you the technical explanation? Because he said there's several reasons why you could hear things a certain way. In other articles, it talks about people in different ages, different age groups, because how well do we hear versus when we're younger? I'll never forget, I was in somebody's car. I don't know what exactly the situation was, if he was driving me to a bris or whatever, and he starts telling me how he had spent so and so much money to get the front two speakers from this country, the back two speakers, one of them was from France, because, and the sound, and this and this. I was in my 30s, I'll tell you how I remember. And he plays some music. And I say, I hear a little bit of distortion. And he's this whole sound engineering type, whatever. He says, how old are you? I told him. He says, because, I see. Because once you get to 40, then you begin to hear less and less. The way you hear, it goes down. Of course, we know about hearing aids. But the point is, it starts much earlier. It's progressive. So how we hear things, how we perceive, part of it has to do about us physically. In other words, what is our ability to hear? But then there's also the perception. He mentioned, like if you know somebody with the name Laurel, maybe you'll hear Laurel. And what really was something to me that in different clips, and I'm listening to, on the same headphones, different clips, and I'm hearing like this. And then even in the New York Times, the slider thing, it didn't always work out at the same spot for me. It was different. So here's how this goes. This story, so now let's go to the story. There's a kid, and he's a real troublemaker in class. Okay, even if I butcher the story, but you'll get the message. A kid, he's a real troublemaker in class, and because it's in recent times, the teacher's speaking to the parents, of course, you got to do something. Maybe ADHD, you got to give him Ritalin. I'm not stating any opinion about Ritalin, but I just know that there's a lot of people on Ritalin and a lot of people in the medical community think it's bonkers that it's been giving out so much. And some people say it's a good thing. They can figure it out, not me. Anyway, so what ends up happening? They send this kid to school with Ritalin. Fine, because he has to take Ritalin. Now this boy, because the teacher wanted to give him something to get up and do some movement, he'd make this boy the one, every day he'd go to whatever it was, where they had the samovar, and to make him a coffee, bring in the coffee. Anyway, a couple of weeks later, so the parents and the teacher, they're speaking, and how's it going? And he says, oh, the Ritalin has made such a difference. Ah, wonderful. Okay, great. He's so much calmer, this and that and the other. Let me speak to the boy. And they ask him about, the teacher says, you're so much easy to handle and so on and so forth because of the Ritalin. He says, I know. Every day I make his coffee, I put the Ritalin in his coffee. Now, you see, this thing about Laurel and Yanni, here's what really struck me, and I must say to you, it did smack me in the face in a hard way, not a bad, agonizing way, but in a big way as follows. Like any other thinking person, I have opinions. We all have opinions. And there's certain areas, and I say to myself, how could people see things the opposite? I'm just going to say two political words. Nobody comment, because if you comment, it means we're all getting into trouble. But I'll just say two words. Liberalism, conservatism. Now, one of those words, especially if you're from the United States, where this is an absolute religion, one of those words got under your skin. And the other word, you have a love affair with the other word. Maybe in Canada, we're a little milder. I don't know, and I don't want to ask right now. And whichever word of the political spectrum is your word, How could anybody see things differently? And here, I see that it's possible that you have a message. My own ears. Now, there's something I didn't want to get too far into. I just mentioned it a couple of years ago, and many of the articles, they mention it. There was a similar situation with a certain picture of a dress. Just a dress like hanging on a hanger. What color is it? Blue? Is it golden and white? Some people see it blue and something, and some people saw it, right? I'm seeing, you're seeing. And whatever, I figured I don't need to go too far because there were all sorts of websites explaining why is it, how I could make you see it both ways, da 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 da. But the point is that what we're seeing here is we can look with our eyes and hear with our ears and we'll get a different message. So I'm not saying at all that when God spoke and both were heard, Shamor and Zachor, that he did an overlay. Hey, listen, I am not God, and God is not that small that he needs to, the only way he could do it is by making an audio overlay. That's just juvenile, that's stupid. But the point that I want to bring out is that God was giving a message concerning Shabbat. And I'll just talk about Shabbat for a second, and then we're going to come to Bamidbar, which means in the desert. And he said to the Jewish people in that fourth commandment, I want you to keep Shabbos. I want you to keep Shabbos. Now, you could have a personality where the more restrictive you can convince yourself will make you more of a moral person. In other words, you revel in the restrictiveness. So you could hear, keeping Shabbos, yeah, you don't do this, and you don't do this, and you don't do this, and you don't do this. And when I don't do this or this or this, I feel really holy because look what I'm sacrificing for God. I'm not saying that's bad or good. I'm just saying that it is such a way, such an approach. Now you have some other people. You keep Shabbos. Oh, I love Shabbos. What do you love about Shabbos? Ah, Shabbos comes in and I just cut off the whole world from me. We sit down at the table and it's a delight to the eyes, to the smells, to everything, and the food and the camaraderie and the singing and da-da-da-da-da-da. Beautiful. For some people, oh, finally, I get a schluff. I can really see the second one is the remembering Shabbos. And you've heard me say so many times, and surely I will repeat it many times over the years, that there is a mitzvah to add pleasure on Shabbos. Food, clothing, sleep, being intimate, literally, it's in Code of Jewish law, right? Not like a robot. Pleasure, instead. So the truth of the matter is that Yiddishkeit is a coexistence of a contradiction, and any one of us, based on who we are, how we've been raised, what stage of life we are in, we're going to perceive it a certain way. And what the message here is, and we're going to see right now, because we're going to go now to the parsha, is you see it a certain way, and that is great. But God is saying opposing things at the same time. Can you put, as they say, your ear to the ground? And can you hear the message that's not in your present comfort zone? Not to penalize yourself. Okay, penalizing yourself, that belongs to another religion. Because God wants us to serve God with joy. But the point here is, you're only hearing one dimension. It's, for example, if you go... I don't go to discos, obviously, ever. But I do know that we've taken camp to a skating rink, and they put on music. And I'm an audio person, I have to say. I learn through audio, and I listen deeply to music and all of that. And it would drive me bonkers. What would drive me bonkers? That they turn up the bass, just the bass. Whatever the music was playing, I don't care. But only the bass. What happened to the rest of the sound? In other words, like very, just to see things one way. And rhythm is a big deal. Because there was a time when I was a kid when I was dreaming of becoming a drummer. I'm just telling you, okay? And anytime there was a wedding or something, then I would, my eyes would be glued to the drummer. I kid you not. But now, you know, then you get to stage and you hear there's other parts of music. And I have, for example, said many times over here that in the West we're so into like listening to, nobody sings, that they're missing a whole dimension of living by not singing. So the point is, Yiddishkeit comes along and we see certain things and, oh, that really, it's up our alley. Can I put my ear to the ground and hear something that seems the opposite and different? Because maybe I'm missing a whole dimension on life, right? Now let's go to the parasha and we're going to see. So the first book, we're still on page 848. Don't have to turn the pages. The first book is called Bereshis, which is Genesis. When I say Genesis in English, because that's really how everything began. I'm not saying it's a translation of the word Bereshis. Of course, it's not. Well, I shouldn't say it's not. But that's not my department. But it's the beginning of all things. The second book of Shemot is the development of the Jewish people getting ready, you know, into Egypt, out of Egypt, giving up the Torah, building the tabernacle. And then the third book, Vayikra, the calling of the Jew. And we've discussed this at length, even this year and certainly in previous years. And now we come to the fourth book, and it's called Bamidbar, in the desert. So what is the desert? It's a place of desolation. Why would, now that you've built up the first three books, and the third book is about your calling. It's about your calling. And now you come to the fourth book, and you say, in the desert. Well, maybe it's in the first line. That's not, we've said this countless times, that's not why they're given the names. The reason why it's one of the beginning words is because that choice of one of the beginning words is there because it's thematic of the whole book. But the truth of the matter is that this is exactly the point, that we could look at this world, we could have many perspectives. Some people say, the world is my stage. Okay, whatever they mean by that. I know what they mean, but you can look at the world and you say, this world is a jungle. You know, you have, there's animals who eat each other alive. You have humans who eat each other alive. You know, politicians, they eat each other alive. And you have people who are gangsters against the law. And you have people who are gangsters through the law. You'll excuse me, whoever's listening to the recording. And they're called lawyers. You want to get off scot-free and being a mafianic and get off scot-free, just have enough money for the top lawyer, and so on and so forth. So you could look at the world that way. Or you could look at the world and you say, what a wonderful place. How we can develop things and we can creative and make things accomplishment. The truth of the matter is, when we look at the world, regardless of the descriptions that I just gave, we also have a view of the world that what is reality? What you see, what you hear is reality. Well, is reality Laurel or Yanni? You see what I'm saying? Is the dress gold and white, or is it a different color? And the thing is that of course we see reality. Of course we see the physical reality the way we do, which in and of itself changes during our lifetime, which should give us a little hint. All right? Because how many of us appreciate classical music? Whatever the answer is, whoever said yes, how much classical music did you appreciate at age 19? No. And the answer is nobody. Okay? Almost nobody. Maybe, you know. So the point is that this world, you could look at it in whichever way you want, but here's what the world really is. The world is a desert where you can make it bloom. The Jewish people traversed through the desert and worshiped God. So this is the name of the Torah portion. This is from a talk of the Rebbe, this last point, that this is the whole theme. So you see the world, you see it one way, you see it another way. I want to connect this to another class that I gave a few weeks ago in which I read two stories. Because a certain woman I mentioned who had lost a child. And the reason I say that is because what I'm going to follow, anybody could say, but I don't know if there is a greater suffering than a mother losing a child. And in her case, it was in a car accident. So it's just... And she says to me, you have to thank God for your troubles. And I came to class the next day and read some stories on that theme, because what a perspective, and it's been reverberating through my consciousness from then until now, and if ever my mood is slipping downward, that's part of my wake-up call, right? So you think you're going into the darkness, but what do you mean to thank God for your problems? So this is the first thing about the name of the Torah portion. And now what we're going to do is we're going towards the end of the parasha, and we're going to see something that is also going to follow along this path. So in this vein, before we go to the end of the parasha, we're back to page 848, because I realized I had missed this. What does it say in the second verse? Take a head count of the children of Israel. So now, when you're counting people, you're counting them as individuals, and then turn the page, and you'll see how it says who the head of the tribe was. But then, at the bottom of page 850, it starts giving you numbers of each tribe. And let's keep going, pages of tribes, and so on. And eventually, on page 854, it says, "Vayu kol pekudei b'nei Yisrael beis avosam," that the entire count of the Jewish people, and it gives a number. Now, you could have started off by saying that God, that Moshe took a head count, and the number was 600,000, approximately. It's a bit, right? Why do you have to go through it? Because this is the point that we've heard over and over again. And again, the question is, which do you hear more naturally? Rugged individualism or the group? In Judaism, it's very clear. It's not just rugged individualism, the way of the United States. It's not just the group, the way of socialism, communism, and everything that those, especially communism, has wrought. But there really is both. So remember I said before, two political streams, and I said two words, conservatism, liberalism. So the truth of the matter is, in one of them, there is a dominance over the individual, and in the other one, there's a dominance over the group. So whichever one is your, I don't know in Canada, and I don't want to really ask, I don't think people have such a love affair with their political views as they do in the States. There, it's like a total religion, and they have to stick in. They have a certain religious practice in the United States. Thou shalt call thine enemy a racist. That's what I've observed. I'm just saying, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, which party, it doesn't matter. You're a racist. Why? But my point is, so if you are more drawn towards individualism, what about the group? Can I put my ear to the ground and become more of the group? If I'm more into the group, can I put my ear to the ground and hear about individualism? So we're seeing again the same theme, the coming together of the two opposites, that's really what it is. The Yanni and Laurel, that they are coming together. So with that in mind, we are now going to go to the end of the Torah portion, towards the end of the Torah portion, in which we are on page 868. So here we see in verse 40, it says, "Vayomar Hashem Moshe, pekod kol bechor zachar lebnei Yisrael ben chosh v'mala." From the tribe of Levi, they started counting them from age 30 days and on. But now, I'd like you to turn one page to page 870. Because after counting them from age 30 days, now there's another counting for the tribe of Levi. God says to Moshe as follows, verse 2, "Naso, you should take a head count of the children of Kohos from Levi." And there's going to be actually three families. There is Gershon, and there is Kohos, and there is Merari. And here, they're going to be counted, verse 2. It says, verse 3, I'm sorry, from age 30 until 50. Just a window of 20 years. From age 30 until 50. And it goes on to say that within that tribe, this is what they had to do. They had to carry these particular items. Okay. Let's now go back to 862. Because I just switched the order accidentally. In other words, Kohos. But if you take a look at 862, there again they're being counted from a month, and then they're being told about what their job is going to be. And there are three sons. If you take a look at verse 17 and 864, the children of Levi were Gershon, Kohos, and Merari, and then it goes on to say their descendants. Now let's turn the page. I'm going to ask you now to go to the beginning of next week's Torah portion, which is 876, because we spoke about, we had the children of Kohath over here in the end of the last of this Torah portion of this week, and the following week's Torah portion continues the same subject. Naso et Rosh B'nei Gershon, verse 22 on page 876. The children of Gershon, and again, it's age 30 to 50. They are not, like the Kohos, they were carrying the various utensils. The people of Gershon, they're going to carry the curtains. Now we go to the very bottom of 876, and in the English it begins on the next page, and it says, B'nei Merari, the children of Merari, and they would carry, on page 878, the walls of the Mishkan when they traveled through their desert, through the desert. So now what I'd like to do is we're going to turn page just so that we can have the three names in one verse. We are going to go back to page 864, verse 17, because we're going to speak about the children of Levi, which is three branches of the tribe of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. So here we're going to see that there are three approaches in life, and they were personified by each family here. Now you may say, well, I'm not from the tribe of Levi, so what does this have to do with me? Well, I've said this very many times over the years, that the Rambam points out, and he brings, based on a verse which says, that you shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. So the Rambam says on that, that any person who wishes can dedicate themselves to God to reach the spiritual connectedness to God, the way the tribe of Levi connected to the Almighty. Which means to say that now that we're going to be speaking about these three families, they had three different jobs, it tells us about three different aspects. So what does this have to do with the audio? It has everything to do with the audio that we started off with. Because instead of having now two words at the same time, we have three concepts at the same time, and we may find one speaks to us more, one speaks to us less, and one speaks to us the least. And we come back to the same thing, that the Torah portion is ending with three that are really from one tribe. The idea that if you're Yanni, then what about, then find Laurel. And if you're Laurel, you should find Yanni, really the same idea. So I'd like you to take a look at the name. We'll just do it in the order. Actually, we won't do it in the order, but you'll take a look at the name of Gershon. The name of Gershon on page 864, the second line in the Hebrew and second line in the English. What is the meaning of the name Gershon? So I'm going to tell you something. It's going to sound terrible. And I'm telling it to you on purpose. Because really, what sounds terrible is really the opposite. The word Gershon, now I know that Gershon, his name, actually I said this in a yahrzeit, now I remember. So I don't think any of you were there actually. So it's okay for me to repeat it. Gershon, he was called that name. That's the son of Moshe. That's Gershon with a mem. But that doesn't matter. Anyway, Gershon, the name Gershon is like the word Gerushin. Gerushin means to reject, to divorce, is called Gerushin. So what kind of a name is this? Now, let's take a look at what did he do? What did the family of Gershon do? The family of Gershon, what we're told in the beginning of next week's Torah portion is that they carried all of the tapestries and curtains, which were huge, absolutely huge. I'm not pulling out the pictures right now, because we've done that at a different time of the year. And they would carry the tenting. That's really the word in English. The tenting of the tabernacle. What is tenting? What tenting does, it keeps out all of the unwanted elements, the cold, the heat, the rain, the wind, to maintain the right atmosphere, the right aura, the right all-encompassing situation that is within the tent. So, in other words, a tent repels the unwanted in order to maintain the desirable aura.
But it does the opposite as well.
I'm sorry?
It does the opposite as well,
meaning?
Keeping out.
And this is what I'm saying. It keeps out the undesirable. It keeps in and out. Oh, precisely. It does two things. It keeps out the unwanted and keeps in what you do want. So therefore, this word Gershon is a very positive thing. Every one of us, we know that there's certain things we better keep out. If you have nothing to keep out, why don't you just go into the field and sleep in the rain, sleep in the snow, etc., etc., literally, figuratively, and so on. So that's the name Gershon. And now we take a look at an opposite. We'll go to the last name, Merari. And the word Merari means bitterness. It's another name, which at first blush, you say, like, what is that? What did Merari do?
Is that Maror?
Like Maror, bitter, precisely. It's the same word. Maror, Merari. That's right. So, what did they do? They would carry the walls, in other words, the whole structure, the skeleton of the tabernacle. This is another beautiful thought from the Rebbe. Because if we all need to have structure. You can't just have an aura. You cannot just live with an aura. You know, curtains, it's interesting, even though I mentioned tenting, you could say the same thing about any walls and roof, but tenting has a fluidity to it, right? You can make the tent like this, and you could pull it like that, and maybe it'll open up a little bit, let in a little bit of air, and so on. But when it comes to a skeleton, there's certain things, they do have to be just like this. Now, some people, there's a certain people of the world, the German people, and they're very punctual about a lot of things. And they were so punctual, we know about how punctual they were during the war and how calculated they were and how they slaughtered the Jewish people. So I'm mentioning that just because of the proximity to the Second World War, it always comes up. But the truth of the matter is, there is something to being organized, and that every minute counts, and that you're very careful. There's something to having a skeletal structure. I mean, you just think of the motto of what's it called? The name of the university in Olympia, Green. What is it? I forgot. Evergreen. Thank you. Their motto is literally, let it all hang out. What kind of a life is that? To live like a jellyfish? What kind of a life is that? Let it all hang out, right? You know, anyway. So the point is, you need to, yeah. So we need to have, so what is bitterness? Bitterness, now bitterness, is bitterness always bad? Bitterness is not always bad. I'll tell you something interesting. If you have coffee, ever, do you know what goes into coffee? Four elements. Think about this for a second. Coffee is bitter. Sugar, or whatever your sweetener of choice is sweet. You put them together. But you use hot water, and then you add cold milk. You have sweet and bitter and hot and cold, and you mix it together, and you have a nice coffee. Okay? So the point is, structure is very important. So bitterness isn't always bad. Sometimes you just have to be firm in a certain way because that's the only way it's going to be. In other words, if all the traffic lights were green, traffic would be at a standstill, right? We all know that. So they would carry these things on wagons. They were obviously enormous and heavy. They would carry them on wagons, and you'll soon see why I make that point. Because now we come to the name in the middle, which is Kohos. Now, Kohos, they were specifically ones who did not use wagons. They carried the furnishings, which are small items, things that they're doing themselves, but they're also they're things that are much holier. Because if you think about it, the aura, and I'll stick in a word here, atmospherics, for some people that's a big deal. It has its role, and the firmness, and the structure, and the foundation, it has its role. And then you have the specifics. The specifics is where you actually fulfill the purpose. You fulfill the purpose using the utensils. That's where you fulfill the purpose. And that's already very personal. So Kohos, they didn't use wagons. They would carry the items individually and personally. So now we can look at ourselves and we go to where we started, except that we don't have three, we have two. We have structure and we have aura and keeping out the unwanted. And then we have, what do I actually do? So I'm going to use myself. So am I a person where everything has to be perfectly balanced? And if I come in, see that picture's a little tilted to the side, I got to straighten it out. Everything has to be perfect. So I have a beautiful atmosphere, but then what actually happens? Or I could be absent-minded about it, and when I get into the nitty-gritty is all happening. I will say something about it as follows, that the biggest Jewish website by any stretch is Chabad.org, and all of its sub-websites, such as we have ourselves, which is all coming from one root. So when I took, I did this a couple of times, I took a couple of people to New York for a visit, one of the things I showed them is the inner workings where all the people sit there with computers, and they have one big room, and there's tons of guys and computers, and another part of the building, I have a big room, tons of women, because they're no mingling, you understand? But they're all doing, this is what they're doing, working on the computers and so on and so forth. But what was very interesting is that the building, it was an old building, but there were no furnishings. The floor was worn out and cracked, and the stairs were worn out. In other words, if they were another company, they would mahogany or whatever, you know, all of the trappings. But Chabad.org, it's the most significant, it really is the most significant Jewish website, is the most hits, reaches the most people. There are many, many, many good websites. But they're focusing on getting the job done. And the room that they're in, no big deal. There are no professional layouts doing that. So there's something about paying attention to getting the job done. And of course, structure, I think we all understand. And those of us who have a deficiency in maintaining structure know even better than the people who use structure how important structure really is. So the point is, where we started, we have a certain tendency, a certain way, put our ear to the ground, hear the other way, and see if we can hear the singularity of God's voice coming through all of the opposite and contradictory elements that we encounter. Okay? Thank you all.